Welcome to the Future of Healthcare, Live with Intent podcast, with Thomas Reichart and Justin Tomlinson, authors of Live with Intent and architects of the LWI Learning Pathway. Justin and guest host Dr. Wolfgang Golisch step into the cockpit with Thomas Reichart. Thomas is a perpetual student, always curious, always learning. He has mastered the art of modern managerial effectiveness.
So, welcome to the Future of Healthcare podcast. Today, we have another special edition where we've invited our co-host, Wolfgang Golisch, back. Welcome, Wolfgang.
Thank you, Justin. Great to see you.
Thank you. And Wolfgang, Thomas and I were... Well, we're often reflecting on having you join our team a little over a year ago. And honestly, we're both so pleasantly surprised. We're constantly saying, who is this guy? We had no idea that you were going to create so much value on our team. And we couldn't be more pleased to have you join us as a co-host on this podcast.
Thank you, Justin. It was a great year working together with you, and I really feel part of the team. That was a very generous invitation, and how it all works together. We three, everybody bringing his piece to the table. We had a very successful year and made a good impact, and with many people whom we coached and with whom we had interactions.
So, with pleasure, welcome as the co-host. We have the pleasure, you and me, to interview Thomas today and let our listeners get to know him a little bit more as a human being, as a person. So why don't you kick us off, Wolfgang?
Yes, I will. Thomas, welcome.
Thank you. I got to say, it's an honor to be interviewed by my lifelong friend and lifelong colleague, Justin. Gosh, what a blessing. Not many people have that in their career, that, you know, for 20 years plus, they have a sound, reliable, and absolute first-class experience with their friend and their colleague. And the same is for you, Wolfgang, you know, working with you for the last year and years. I count you to be part of the complete crew here, and thank you for giving me the privilege to be interviewed.
Thomas, I met you a few years after I had met Justin. He brought us together and made us good friends. And I was reflecting, who is Thomas? And so the first question, obviously, then the first big theme that comes to one's mind is flying. You grew up at an airport. You learned how to fly, how to be a glider pilot at an age of 12 years old, probably before you could even get the license. Then single engine planes, air shows, aerobatics, turbine and multi-engine aircraft. So this has translated into a metaphor for your life. What have you learned from flying, and how does it translate into the work you are doing now?
Well, thank you for starting a question on flying that makes it easy for me. Why is that so important for me? I love the cockpit. I don't know, you know, the first time I sat in a cockpit, it was this thing like I felt like I'm in a sweet store, right? I'm like in a store where I can buy chocolate. It felt like, wow, this is a cockpit, right? And I couldn't believe that this whole thing worked. And to me, it was inconceivable that all these gadgets, all these buttons, all these yokes, and all these things made sense. And actually, there were people that could actually do something with it. For me, being in the cockpit, if I think of last week or 2 weeks ago or last Saturday, being in the cockpit, it gives you this basic stress level. You know, this thing is real. You can't just park it on the ride. It gives you this focus. It gives you this ability to, this need to actually be absolutely present. When I was 17, I came across this quote by the Spanish philosopher who says, Ortega y Gasset, who said, life is thrown at you point blank, meaning that thing just goes at you. And it's like, you know, flying, you can only do fly forward. You can't fly backward. You can't think backward. You just, this thing just in the present goes forward. And this has become a metaphor for life for me. And I see this in our client organizations. I see that in the teams that we work with the individuals that we coach. This ability to be in the present, this ability to have energy to go forward. I think that's what we need. I think that's where we can add value. And it just makes it so visible for me.
Thomas, I wonder if you could say a little bit about your stepdad and what he meant to you in flying, because I think he was one of the top mechanics for Lufthansa for many years and got you into restoring planes and flying planes. And it seems to me like he's had a big role in your love and understanding of flying.
Absolutely. I grew up with my stepdad and my mom, and my stepdad, Hans Reichert, he was an engineer and a examiner of aircraft, and we had our own aircraft engineering place. So when I grew up at age 10 onwards, when I opened the door in my children's room, right, the next room was a Messerschmitt metal fuel. It was oil. And then it was all the way across and then some steps up, and that's where the kitchen was, right? So, I mean, that was my playground. And I will never forget the early times that he gave me responsibility. He always had run-ins and challenges at the airports, at multiple airports, where the flight instructors and the owners of the airport or of the flight schools would come to him and say, you know, you can't let this 17-year-old, 18-year-old boy fly with such a warbird. You know, it's just not real. You can't give a 19-year-old that kind of plane. And he would just always shrug and say, you know, a couple of years ago, we had a war in this country and the 16-year-old people flew, my son can fly this thing. And he just let me go, right? And it was just this amazing trust that he had. I knew that those planes weren't insured. I knew that, you know, that thing had to land and I wasn't going to get a parachute. But it was this incredible sense of trust, the sense of trust of, you can do it, just get on with it. And he was working for the Lufthansa Berlin Foundation in Fontenay Aerospace and had amazing engineering skill. That was a complete new world for me. And still today, it touches me to be connected with the legacy that he left.
And he left one project undone before he died. And you finished that off. What is that?
Yeah, believe it or not, I mean, all my youth and since I was 10 till I was 30 and plus, I heard every day when I spoke with him, yeah, we're going to finish this Messerschmitt. And he was restoring an original Messerschmitt 108, which he couldn't completely finish before he died at age 66, sadly, because he finished so many other planes for other groups and for other people. And for the Lufthansa Berlin Foundation, he restored also a Messerschmitt. So his own one was never the highest priority. So it was kind of like half finished or a third finished. So I took it on the last years to finish that. And after 47 years of restoration time, 2 years ago was the first time we had our first flight again, and the first flight experiments again with the plane, and got it insured and got it again certified in Germany as a warbird.
I've never seen your eyes more shiny than when you announced it is done.
Yeah, it felt like, you know, this thing since when you're 10 years of age, and it felt like, yeah, I felt I felt a duty, you know, this had to get finished. And I'm grateful for the Messerschmitt Foundation that was supporting it, and for Airbus and for Mr. Bende, who puts so much energy and so much heart into finishing it and into helping me put this legacy back into the air. Today, I feel the sense of accomplishment of, okay, it's done. Finally, it's done, right? Because it was a lot of material. It was many rooms full of metal, and it's so great to see it back together.
Congratulations, Thomas. So I confirm what Justin said. I mean, your shining eyes when the thing was ready. And
thank you.
Yeah, that's fascinating. This focus, this commitment, and what I understand from flying, it's really focus, concentration. Maybe you can make a mistake, but not in certain situations. Everything must work perfectly. So, what is for you the connection between flying and leadership?
Well, first of all, I think you are the pilot in command. So as pilot in command, you have the last say. So you control the aircraft and there is no second guessing who's responsible. So you have responsibility for whoever you could endanger outside the aircraft, and you have responsibility for everyone who is on board. And your decisions are final, and you have to make them quickly. You don't have a lot of time to align, to discuss, to think. So when it comes to leadership, I think the first thing is this: there is no way about it. There's nothing to discuss. You are the pilot in command, so you just got to do it. Now, in leadership, obviously, it gets complex because a lot of people are involved. So, you know, the metaphor is only partial transferable into leadership. But that I think, is the furthermost one. I am responsible. I have to be proactive, and I have to take responsibility for my actions and for my decisions. And there will be forensic evidence about my decisions if I'm not careful. Number one. Number two, I see a lot of connections to the field of management. Many times in organizations, we oversee the basics of management and we almost over-glorify leadership. So for management, flying gives us a wide array of metaphors and ways of grasping very important management principles. For example, I like the idea of, you know, having different levers in order to control your plane. So you have this control yoke, right, where you go through different axes. So it's like you're able to go upwards or downwards or get into turns. And we'd like to compare the control yoke to the calendar. So how clear are you controlling your calendar? Are you owning that in management as a practice? Or the power lever, right, where you give throttle or you inject fuel into the engine or where you ensure that the turbine gets more power. That power lever should be one lever that you must at all times control pretty consciously, very mindfully, understanding that if you control that too fast, too slow, that would end many stable flying phases and could lead you to very critical situations. We like to compare the power lever to the to-do list manager, right? So imagine, you know, you're not serious about your to-do list. You've got many to-do lists. And all the management has to have that. You have to have a flight management system. You have to know how you manage your details. You could compare that to your note-taking application or your fuel system to the way you manage your files. So I see a lot of comparisons. The other thing that in flying, you have to have your routines and procedures right. If you don't know your procedures when you do a landing or you do a takeoff, that's when, you know, when you have very high workload and most accidents happen at landing or at takeoff. This is where you need to have your procedures right. And you need to have your routines absolutely practiced really well. What are your procedures in management, in leadership? What are your practices that you actually really know, that you really train? I think there's a wide field to compare those practices. And again, in management, in leadership, we are left to thinking or we're left to pondering, I should practice more. I should be having more intent. I should be more clear about how I steer this organization. I could be much more clear about what horizon we have, I have, our team could be having, should be having, and we should align all these processes we continually do as we steer an aircraft.
And Thomas, even with all of those levers, all of that training, all of that structure, we often joke about you that you've already spent your nine lives because of the nature of your profession in flying old restored aircraft. You've had many emergencies, many, I think, even crashes. I actually witnessed a crash. And so, again, we joke that you've had nine lives. So even with all that infrastructure, things still go upside down. What have you learned from that part of flying?
There are critical incidents. And when you fly old aircraft and when you fly a historic aircraft for air shows, and then you are entering a different space, yes, because the reliability of the engine, the reliability of the aircraft, and also of the structural parts of the aircraft is different. Those planes are 70, 80 years old, and some of them have war history. So you probably will have critical incidents, yes. But as we teach in Chapter 12 of Live With Intent, every crisis that you're not prepared for will really hit you. That really has the power to get you out of your seat. So the key is preparation. The key is training. The key is understanding and knowing what you're doing. I have no intent of getting myself into dangerous situations, but it does require very clear and crisp presence to operate a historic aircraft, yes. Also, what I would say, what I've learned is, you're continually looking out for the next airfield to land. So it's not an operation like in a modern aircraft where you say, let's, you know, fly to Sylt or let's fly to Vienna and that's it. You're operating at a different modus, and the operation is you're looking out also for what's the next alternative to emergency land. What's the next alternative if something goes wrong now? And so if that does happen, you're prepared. And we see that in organizations as well, right? Things do go upside down. We come into critical, crucial conversations. We come into critical, crucial transformation settings. We come into surprises that we didn't think. And how good are those that are prepared, that can stay calm, and that have the training to know what to do in critical situations? A friend of mine, and also a dear friend of mine who's also a pilot, he was a kidney surgeon. He taught me this principle. All these years of training, all these years of becoming a kidney surgeon, he said, I could make you a kidney surgeon within 4 weeks. You could do the basic surgery without having studied for years. But you couldn't do what's necessary when the vessel breaks, when the blood vessel breaks, and when the emergency set in. So the difference in basic training and in advanced training and what we do managerial and leadership training, the difference is to get you prepared for critical incidents and to make sure that you have a stress-free productivity in the eye of danger and that you're able to do your job because you are then pilot in command.
So in addition to flying, Wolfgang, have you ever met anybody who is more committed to learning and enrolled in more educational activities than Mr. Reichardt? I mean, this guy is constantly in some session.
It's true. I mean, it's impressive and it's good for us. So whenever we need something, we need an idea, we have a question, we know where to go. So Thomas, I think one can say you are addicted to education. You are a constant student. And given what we just heard from you, probably we can imagine the answer. Where did this appetite for learning come from? At least I think it was also triggered by the experiences you made as a pilot. But tell us more.
I don't think I've ever told you the full story, dear friends, but I'll do it today. Okay. So I've had distinct experiences in my life. One was a really crucial moment, and that was when I was about, I think it was 10 or 11 years of age. And the question was, where does Thomas go after the fourth grade? And in Germany, we have this deal that you either go to gymnasium and go into an academic school or you don't. And at the time, the school system wasn't as supportive as it is now, where at a later stage, you could then still learn more. And my mom did not allow me to go after fourth grade to gymnasium. She's like, you're not going to the higher school and you're not going to go to university. There's no way. We don't allow that. So I was faced with parents that were absolutely convinced that this is not going to go. And no, we're going to forbid you to study. So luckily, my stepdad stepped in. Yeah. And he was an enabler very early in my life. And he said, whatever you are doing as parents doesn't make sense. This boy wants to study, and study he should. So he really put his foot down and convinced my parents that that would be possible. And I had this little sting between my mom and me, my dear mom and me, about, was it right? Should you really be allowed to study? And I just loved school, and I really excelled in school. I got to say, I mean, I lived in Bavaria in the 80s, South Germany, what a place to live. I was fortunate to go to the US at age 17 for a year as a foreign exchange student. I had a very deep gratitude for being able to learn. So for me, learning was always the promise of a different life. For me, learning was always, if you're allowed to learn, you'll have different options. And if you're allowed to learn, you don't have to stick here with a chicken, right? You can actually go up and fly, and there's stuff you can do. Then also early in my life, I was in Istanbul for a while. My stepdad had a number of years of work there. And we as a family for many months were in Istanbul. And so what I saw there, people that were not learning or did not have access to learning, it just totally ingrained in me this gratefulness and this luxury of learning. I understand that is a commitment now for us, and that is a responsibility to do something with the things we've learned. But I was in Seattle in Washington State, and at the time I was 17 and I went to high school. Almost every high school student had a job. And they had a job, right, to earn money to pay for later their university or for other things. We didn't do that in Germany and in Europe. When you were a student, and, you'd flake off in the summer and have vacation, but you wouldn't study and work year in, year out. So we were really privileged and to be able to learn, and looking at different cultures and being exposed to that early in life, I really appreciated learning. And to me, it's still up today the biggest luxury and what I enjoy doing.
What I've now learned with that story is behind that sense of you enjoy learning, it's a pleasure. The real truth is it's a form of rebellion for you.
That's right. That's right. I'll show you guys I can study, right? Yeah, yeah. And isn't that the case, right? Isn't that the case that in many unique talents that our clients have or we have, we see that underneath somehow there is maybe a situation, a conflict, or this deep urge to compensate for something. Yeah, absolutely.
So I had the privilege to come and attend your Duke University MBA graduation, which was really fun. And when I looked at all of the syllabus and all of the work that went into that, I clearly was happy that I didn't sign up for it. But what was it about Duke that you took away? Because it seemed to have quite a profound impact on your thinking and on what's possible.
Thank you again for coming. I will never forget that you and Dave showed up, right, in the middle of North Carolina for the graduation back then. Two things, I think. First of all, I did not know the depth of the academic field of managerial effectiveness. I did not know how deep that goes, what's possible to measure, and what cool field of study managerial effectiveness is. I still feel the excitement of sitting in class and learning about trust and learning about cultural diversity and learning about change processes and how to bring that together. That impacted me deeply. And I actually did not know that you could go that deep. That was fascinating to me. And second of all, it was this experience, I'm bigger than this damn spreadsheet. With, you know, you'd get this homework or you'd get this exam and you'd get these calculations and these complex spreadsheets about valuations or about economic value added and what, I mean, all these things that you do in university. But it's like, there you are, it's Friday evening and you just have no clue how to solve that spreadsheet, right? And so, you know, this experience that if I dedicate, you know, 15, 20 hours to this thing, and if I spend the weekend to just get it, I'll solve that problem. I'm bigger than it. And I seriously recall the evenings and the mornings of those struggles where I committed, I'm going to be bigger than this spreadsheet. And that still carries through to today. And I think that's probably the biggest value of what, you know, the formal education did cost and take out of me. But the biggest takeaway is if I have complex challenges today, I can make the decision and say, you know what, if I really want to, I'm going to get to it. If I really want to, I'll get there. The question is, do I want to spend the next 10, 20 hours to solve it or not, or 100 or 1,000 of hours, depending what we're talking about. But if it's possible, and if I want to, there's a way. And I think that's it's great to see how humans, you know, how you can get human spirit into solving problems and into solving complex problems. That changed my muscle in that regard.
Thomas, you have studied the systemic approach of consulting and coaching, systemic theory, systemic coaching. You have an academic degree in coaching and change management. Why is a systemic approach important for the work we do? Why is that the key?
I think we come from a paradigm of thinking that there are technical problems and then there are experts. And if we involve the experts, we can solve the problems, full stop. And in a lot of areas, that's possible. Financial challenges, you get an expert with financial competence, you get the expertise in, you get to a financial due diligence, you get to the end of the problem. That in many other technical fields, for example, you've got a technical issue with the brake system, you get a technical expert in, they solve the issue, full stop. Very different situation when we're talking about humans, very different situation when we talk about social systems. And systems theory opened my eyes into that there's two areas. There's technical systems and there is social system or human systems. And they operate very differently. They have very different modus operandi. They have different ways of working, different ways of operating. And if we as a management team, as a solution team, as a consulting team want to change, impact, or further enable a social system, we have to go about it very differently than we typically do in expert consulting. And I found that, for example, diagnosing social systems, that's been a skill I didn't have before I studied that. So I really love the methodological approach of how to diagnose teams, how to diagnose executives, how to diagnose their power systems, how to diagnose their influence areas. So the systemic approach to consulting has helped me with a complete deeper tool set in order to help organizations, in order to serve organizations to diagnose where they really are and to be able to set interventions, as we say, or enable them for being ready for their desired future state, or in many cases, even being ready to continue to operate in the midst of the amount of transformations and challenges and speed that they're having to deal with anyways in the first place.
Thank you. I just remember here a quote that you put in one of your booklets. What is allowed to be and what is allowed to be is able to express itself. I like this very much about the systemic approach and waiting how things express themselves and then observe it and then discuss about what we do.
Thanks for reminding us of that. I mean, what I learned is, and I see that every day when we have respect when we have deep respect for what is, and when our expertise is respect and principle-centered respect for the expertise that the client has, that opens doors for us to enable and to create solutions. If we want to empower human systems, nobody's looking for the expertise of us telling people what they're doing wrong. They want to know, how can we empower and take what is, respect what is, and then move on. I see that many teams are quite locked into, can you please just accept where we are? Can you just please give us credit for how we gotten to today? And then they release the solution energy themselves. That's pretty magic to me, right? When we help a team be respectful about how they gotten to today with every team member, and then to actually almost lean back and watch them in the next hour, wherever the process is, and see how all of a sudden the shift comes in, that now the solution energy is released. And it doesn't come from the consultant. It comes from the experts within the organization. That is a thrill to me every time I see it.
Hey, while we're on this topic of learning, it seems to me like you worked your way through the equivalent of medical school as a caregiver with all of the true crises you've had medically within your family. And my impression is that's what's attracted you to the healthcare world. But it may be interesting for our listeners to know a little bit about your experience with healthcare.
Yeah, I mean, we as a family had some more difficult challenges on the health area with our three children. So our three children, Kai, Jacob, and Soraya, were quite seriously ill, very young in their lives, which meant that we as parents had to be in the hospital with them, or we had them in process of getting well again for 10 years. And luckily, they're all healthy again. But from severe kidney surgeries and multiple over dozens of kidney surgeries, both of the boys, and leukemia with our dear daughter, that fight and that battle for 10 years has made us be in the midst of needing healthcare, has made us deeply appreciate the work of healthcare professionals. And it's giving me an incredible gratefulness, obviously, for people that do research, right, that do development, because I know that in the year 1970, if I would have had leukemia the way that Soraya had, chances would have been quite different. So it really is this ongoing service to do development, to solve challenges in the healthcare arena, that I appreciate that. But just as much as I appreciate the people that work in the kitchen and serve you a meal at 2 a.m. or at 4 a.m. when your child is crying the most for spaghetti or for bread or for whatever else the child needs at the time, there are people there to serve you, to help you to do that. In some hospitals and ours, luckily there was. And that was clear a defining moment for me. And I feel today I'm in payback time, that today our work and my work, or I am giving a small part in enabling leaders in the healthcare arena, is meaningful, truly meaningful to me.
So, Thomas, I've heard you speak about that journey as a caregiver a number of times, and the thing that does strike me is how broadly you see that ecosystem. So, for you, one of the most touching parts of the whole story is what you mentioned. It's the people in the kitchen providing the food and those basic comfort needs at 2 a.m. that left such a deep impression on you. So it isn't only the nurses, the doctors, the surgeons, it's a much broader system for you. That's always stuck with me.
Absolutely. I mean, you have your child crying at 2 a.m, right? Or at 4 a.m, and there's nothing you can do. And then it's pizza or spaghetti or schnitzel. And, well, it almost doesn't matter if the child eats it then when he gets it, but that somebody gets up in the middle of the night and creates that for you and is willing to go the extra mile so you at least comfort that child in pain is that's part of the journey, right? That that's part of giving the patient a full experience in knowing you're not alone battling this, you're not alone fighting this. The child isn't alone normally, right? The parents are there, but sometimes as parents, you're quite alone with those cries and those big eyes looking at you. And in our case, we're lucky, right? All three children became healthy again. And yes, there is many things that I would say in the digitalization, in the information flow, in the dialogue, you know, is almost 19th century like on the one hand, and we can compare that, but we had an insurance paying for the medication. We had healthcare, and where we lived in Germany, the children were taken care of, and nobody came and, you know, clamped my house or I'm indebted for the rest of my life for the three children or we as a family. No, that society actually carried that burden with us. And we have three wonderful children today that are all working and paying back society as well. And it just, I just cringe thinking at the different countries that Justin, you and I have traveled to on behalf of healthcare assignments and the amount of countries, Wolfgang, you've been responsible for. When I hear if children have those kind of illnesses that we've had been faced with, that the reality still today looks quite different. That has to drive us. That has to give us energy to get up and make a difference for leaders so that we have less borders, less differences, even within Europe. So there's access granted, and that there is every patient on this planet has the best healthcare possible. And obviously as a parent, you want that. Obviously as a parent, you expect that. And I'm deeply grateful. And yeah, and it's also small moments like Dr. Kamran, one of the kidney surgeons, on the first few surgeries we had when we were just shattered as parents. What do you do now? You know, they're going to remove the kidney of our only and first child. Really, are they going to do that? And, you know, he sat there taking a lot of time talking to us, helping us to understand what that means, what a kidney is and what a reflux is and what it, you know, I mean, I had no clue. And we had no clue as a family what that would mean. But just the empathy of some healthcare professional spending time and really listening to you. Wow. Yeah, it's a whole ecosystem that makes a difference. And that's what I remember most today.
Thank you. I also, if I remember correctly, Dr. Kamran specifically has had an impact and shaped your own contribution in life.
Absolutely, absolutely, Justin. Yeah, and I remember being in the hospital. You know, when you have a baby that goes into surgery, you stand there as parents, and then two or three medical doctors come with a warm blanket. They put this around the baby, and then they disappear through this door. And I couldn't believe Dr. Kamran. He was there at 7 in the morning in his gummy boots, ready to go every time. And, you know, we had multiple surgeries. And, you know, there I was, you know, getting myself out of bed at 7, you know, getting myself to my desk at 8 and thinking that I've got a hard life and that I'm stressed. But then looking at, you know, how a hospital functions and how aware, awake, serving, and now full of discipline you have to be to do that. He had a way to work. He had a family. He had a life. But at 7 in the morning, he was ready to put the scalpel on our son and cut open his body and perform his work at his best ability, at his best capacity. And that brought to me a whole different appreciation for medical doctors, for the responsibility they have, but most of all for the discipline that they bring to their jobs. And this is my wish for us in management, for us in leadership. Let's have the same kind of discipline people have in the cockpit and people have in the surgery rooms. Let's shape up. Let's pull our socks up and be as disciplined. And we learned our tools as well. We learned our trade as well. Let's go with the same vigor into our offices and do our part. I was so inspired by that. And still today, I see that picture in front of me. It inspires me.
Thanks, Thomas.
Thomas, thank you. And you are a pilot, a coach, a consultant, entrepreneur, a father and a friend. And we also know you as a very generous person who shares everything he has. If there's somebody truly embracing the principle of abundance, I would say it's you. You're sharing your knowledge. You shared your house with Justin. Everybody can read the story in the books you wrote together. If we take that away, how would you describe you as a person? What gives you the energy to do all this? How do you recharge your batteries?
Well, thank you for saying that. Very kind. Great thought to be able to be abundant. I want to be that. My children give me energy. They are my heroes. I think they live a real hero story, right? From the beginning till today, that they have a hero's journey, and it gives me energy to see their hero's journey, and I'm their harbor. I want to be, and I am their safe harbor. They can come to at any time, for short time, for long time, whatever they need. There's always a harbor for them. But looking at their hero's journey, that gives me energy. I gotta say, flying just gives it to me. Being at an airfield, sitting in the grass, drinking lemonade and eating an ice cream and hearing some old engines, seeing this element air work, that just triggers me. And obviously reading and learning, absolutely. But next to the heroes of my life, right, it's got to be flying and this whole ecosystem of it's possible, there is a takeoff, things go forward. There are principles that will always work, like physics. That gives me energy.
Thank you, Thomas.
I'd be interested to know how you would describe your defining moments in life, Thomas.
I think for me, there have been moments, but also processes. Just thinking of it, and you're taking me by surprise with this question, which I enjoy. I think number one has to be, I lived in Washington State in Seattle with a dear family for 1 year as a foreign exchange student. That year, that process was a defining moment for me. Completely different culture, completely different country. That probably still shapes me today. I shared some of the defining moments with my dear children. I am every day when I wake up and I see the sun, I'm reminded of a time in Istanbul with my family when I was really young, and a song which is called, you know, every day the sun goes up. Immer wieder geht die Sonne auf. That is an ongoing redefinition of my life, that every day I find super joy in a new day, a new start, hey, I got another day here, you know, and hey, this is another cool experience. To me, life is an incredible present, and I am very grateful for being able to live it, experience it, share it. These moments of introspective, I think you call it, these moments where you realize we're on a very special journey here. We're on a very special time, which is not going to be constant. And it's about our contribution. It's about where do we make a difference? Where is our commitment? Where is our contribution? And doing that with joy, those are the continual defining moments for me. And for me, the sun and the morning and the gift of a new day defines it to me every day again.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for allowing us to pry a little bit into your life and learn a little bit more about you and where you're coming from.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, it was a pleasure for me as well. Thank you, Thomas.
Yeah, and thank you for helping me and for us to get so that we together can make a difference for our clients and in their lives. We just don't know where our influence stops, and that makes it magic for me.
Now let's turn to Thomas and Justin for a brief reflection on today's discussion.
The image that I have of Thomas is him flying at age 14 with the knowledge that he can land in any storm, in any side wind, the mindset that I can manage this challenge, whatever it is. When I've listened to his flying experiences, he truly believes anything is possible, and that's why he's still around after 9 lives of crashes. And for me, that optimism and that belief makes a difference for me in my life.
What impresses me about Thomas is his enormous knowledge and how he is sharing it, and what I could learn from him over the last couple of years, together with the trust that he even allows me to teach that, to coach others now. So this is amazing. So, and I see now from the story, I mean, his stepfather told others, you know, there were 16-year-olds flying in much more dangerous situations. So why should a 19-year-old not fly? And just, I have this in mind. So Thomas knows that I have a bunch of experience in other areas. And now he is sharing with me, and he trusts me to deliver together with him what he has built, and bringing my little piece in as well. So this is impressive to find such a person.
I think if we were to summarize Thomas in one word, it would be the enabler. That's what he does. He enables people.
He enables people, and we enjoy that we can benefit from that a lot.
Indeed. To all of our listeners, thank you for listening. Our desire is to explore and contribute to the future of healthcare by applying the principles of Live with Intent.
For more information on the future of healthcare, Live with Intent, go to www.livewithintent.eu. This podcast was produced by Madeline May.